Members would please take your seats. The meeting will come to order. Members, we're going to start here. We have four bills today. We should be able to manage that in our allotted time, but if not, we do have a room booked for this evening should we need it. So the first bill on the agenda is Representative Detmer. I'll first say, if we have a quorum, I just lost my whole support staff, so.
They're bailing on you?
Do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Okay. Is there someone who has had a chance to look over the minutes that would move to approve?
Madam Chair, I did read the minutes, and I would move the February 26th minutes be approved.
Representative Benson moves approval of the February 26 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 26th are approved. All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Committee members.
So Representative Detmer's House 957, his motion would be to have the bill passed and re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. Would someone please move this bill for Representative Detmer? Is there someone who would? All right. Since Representative Detmer is a guest of our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move the bill for Representative Detmer.
All right. So Representative Cresha moves that House File 957 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. Representative Detmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. First time in front of this committee in the last three terms. But I always have to look back at my years as an educator at Forest Lake High School, 34 years, and I can remember during every year the school would come out with an annual report of what's going on in the district in terms of chemicals that they use in the custodial department or the effects of these chemicals or hazardous waste that might be the asbestos and so forth. This report came out annually in our school. And House File 957 basically looks at providing a statute in the state that we don't have, many states do. In this case, it prohibits construction of a public school within one quarter mile, which is 1,320 feet, of a formal landfill beginning July 2, 2013. Requires existing schools, public schools located within one quarter mile of a formal landfill to annually notify students and employees of that they're that close to a landfill. There's nothing technical about this. It's just to inform the public where the school is located or athletic fields and let the public know. And if there's no additional cost to the schools, they can also put it on their website. But many schools will send out an annual report that could be included. This type of information could be included on that annual report. And defines a landfill by means as a site designated and operated for disposing solid waste. Defines school by means of buildings, athletic fields used for students and public use. So I have two gentlemen here that would like to address this issue. And the first one that would be speaking is Larry Lanou.
If you'd introduce yourself for the record,
yep.
Mr. Lanou.
My name is Larry Lanou, and I reside in the city of Grant, Minnesota. And I'd like to start out and stating that for the past 2 years, I've had the honor to meet and speak with both the members in the House and the Senate on an issue that I'm very passionate about. At this time, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to listen to my concerns. I'd like to give thanks to Representative Detmer and Senator Ray Vanderveer, who introduced his bipartisan bill in the last session. It was a little late to get it through. And then I'd also like to thank the author in the Senate, Karen Housley, for picking up the bill again this year. And along with Bob Detmer again this year as authors. And I'd like to give a special thanks to reviser Bob Elip that took the time to listen and understand the issues that we're considering today. He's written a bill that Minnesota can be proud of, a template that can be shared with the remaining states that don't already have a bill prohibiting siting schools on or adjacent a potential hazardous dump site. And it was while I was meeting with many of our legislators that I learned that last year that I learned that my 6-year-old grandson had come in contact with something that causes white blood cells to go off the chart. My daughter was told to prepare her family for his condition may be terminal. My hope is that none of you sitting here today, along with the families and staff members entering schools sited on or adjacent to the sites, ever have to receive that phone call. Well, speaking to our senators who signed onto this bill as a co-author, one of the senators, we learned that he had a close personal member that worked in a school that was on a list of schools built next to a dump site. He said that the person that he referred to had passed away because of cancer, and he also stated that other persons, along with other staff members, also passed away from that, felt that their illness was related from the building that they worked in. These women felt it was caused by the environment inside the building, although they're probably looking up into the ceiling and should have been looking down to the earth where the school was built on. Awareness and early protection is the key to curing cancer. You know, and prohibiting schools on or adjacent to the site is the best prevention of illness or cancer, of course, but awareness and early detection is the best thing that we can ask for. Now, the families and staff members with a weaker immune system or breathing impairments should have this knowledge before attending these schools so they can make an informed assessment as to whether the risk is worth attending these schools. My daughter did not know about her son's immune system before he became ill. Fortunately, with proper care, my grandson recovered. But with the knowledge and a proximity of a school and a dump site, my daughter now could make an intelligent, informed decision as to whether her son's need would be best served. I've had a lot of documentation. I've shared it with all of you. You've probably seen them, maybe a little strong and passionate. Kathy, I know you've met me in the hall several times, and I apologize for my passion, but I believe this bill deserves to move forward, and it could be used as a template for the remaining states that do not prohibit school setting next to dumps. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Leneau, and there's nothing wrong with passion about something you're serious about. So our next testifier, Mr.
Hello.
Sederstrom?
Yeah, Lawrence Sederstrom. Members. I was a teacher for 29 years. I'm since retired. I've taught for 24 years in the White Bear school system, and as a result, I've worked with young people, and I think it's very important to keep them safe. And I know there's a bill that's been passed that allows parents to have the awareness when pesticides are used in school. So it only seems logical to me to extend this if the schools are built on or near dump sites. I've heard of many cases where, I heard of one case where 30 young gals reunited through Facebook at their 20-year reunion, and of the 30 girls, most of them had the same brain cancer, and their school was built next to a toxic site. So the problem with this is it doesn't happen today or tomorrow. 15 years down the road, it finally rears its ugly head. And we've had other cases like that. So that's why I'm very concerned about this. Once they get together at 10 or 20-year reunions, and all of a sudden they're displaying these illnesses. also, again, with cancer, early detection is especially important. And if you're talking about children that have immune deficiencies, and I'm sure everyone's seen in the news how ADHD and Asperger's, etc., the rate is increasing, so health is becoming an increasingly more important subject in this technological society we have. So that's important. I think parents should have be made aware so they can make their decisions accordingly. It's very important. The children are our future. Now, 29 states have similar laws. I believe Minnesota should join those other 29 states and have a similar type of law. And the last thing I'd like to leave you with, remember, we all want our children to be bright, but we don't want any of them to glow in the dark.
Thank you, Mr. Sederstrom. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, Representative Detmer, I think this is a good idea, but is the quarter mile the right distance? I mean, it seems to me that that's still pretty close.
Madam Chair,
yes,
and
Representative.
Right now, there is no current statute that gives a distance and so forth, but I just felt that given the give and take and so forth, that's 1,320 feet. I guess, you know, that would be up to this committee if they felt that you needed more distance, but from what was the information that was given to me, we came up with the 1/4 mile.
Representative Faust.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. The reason I guess I bring that up is I know a lot of people that live, you know, 2 or 3 miles away from a landfill in Mora, and they're worried about the plume, I guess they call it, in the groundwater that is going to reach their homes eventually, and it's moving that direction, and they're several miles away, but, you know, so like I say, you know, I used to run 1/4 mile, so I know how far that is, and if I can run it, it's not that far.
I ran it too.
So I guess, you know, I support this, but I guess I'd ask you to take a look at what distance the other states have, and if the 1/4 mile is really the right distance, or if it should be 1/2 mile or even more than that.
Madam Chair and
yes,
Representative, I appreciate your commentary. When I start looking at this type of legislation, I can see how tentacle we can get into it, all the different things, and I know the PCA might be coming up today too and speak, but I didn't want to get into that. I didn't want to put any extra burden on the PCA. They don't really need to do anything with this piece of legislation. Also, school districts, I wanted to keep as simple as possible in terms of just informing the public that they're at least this close to, and maybe preventing any other buildings from being built within 1/4 mile. So I appreciate your comments.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple quick questions. First of all, Representative Detmer, do we have an inventory of how many schools this would apply to, roughly, a number?
I've got the number of school districts. There's 5 or 6 school districts. Now, each district will have several different schools within that. So this would apply to any new construction going up that they could not be built within 1/4 mile, but those districts that still have schools within that distance would have to make sure they inform the public.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do think that 1/4 mile needs to be looked at, and I don't know if it's too far or too little, just because, you know, is there a scientific basis behind it? Because certainly, ever who's located within that 1/4 mile radius is going to be marked with some sort of a, you know, whatever. It's they're going to have to put that out, and in times of open enrollment and so forth, a school that's near that versus not near could make a difference. And so I think we need to know if 1/4 mile scientifically is the right distance or not, because if it's 1/8 of a mile, that may or may not exclude some of these districts, and which could make a difference on just, I mean, so what scientifically, you know, to your testifier's very concerned here, because this is legitimate, but what we may or may not know scientifically. So kind of getting back to Representative Faust, 1/4 mile, I know it's arbitrary and we're trying to, but I think that's going to make a difference, because there's going to be schools that are going to be impacted by this.
So Mr. Leno?
Yeah, I'd like to address that. I do have some documentation. It's called Schools on Dumps Across America. Minnesota has 11, and we are probably about the 3rd or 4th worst violator in our country here. Iowa has 1. Louisiana and just only has 1. Wisconsin has 0. The Dakotas have none. So currently we're only on this list are talking about 10 schools. And one of those same schools that showed up on this list is the same school that the senator I referred to said, my aunt went to school, or, you know, and he recognized the name of the school on that list. So we're not talking about a large amount of schools. I think we're only talking about 10 or 11. The biggest deal is the number school buildings is to, you know, prevent more from being built on, because currently there is one that's being built within that distance. So the deal is for awareness. I'll give you an example. My neighbor down the road who would like to have testified here, but she's afraid because of the school district and reprisals. She still has kids in that school, but she was told by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency she moved into a property adjacent to a dump about a quarter mile away several years ago. Within 2 years of moving into that school district, she developed a cancer. It attached it to the set of twins that she was having. She had to terminate her pregnancy, go through 8 months of chemotherapy. She moved out of that neighborhood. I went back last summer, asked one of her neighbors if they could kindly take a inventory of the neighbors that stayed there. Turns out they have a 38% cancer rate on a piece of property the PCA stated to them that was a safe building site.
So, and Representative Marquardt, if you have a follow-up, that's fine. But remember, members, that this bill is being referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. So keep to our purview of education policy, please. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Detmer. I don't want to belabor the point that Representative Faust, Representative Marquardt have just been concerned about, but I'm concerned about it as well and would urge you, Representative Detmer, before the next stop to confer with PCA or some other pollution expert and make sure that a quarter mile is the right distance.
Representative Erickson, R. Erickson. Okay, all right. Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Detmer. This is an important bill. Just a quick question. It doesn't even require an answer, but I'm just thinking, I've been through school construction and a number of projects, and they have to go through an extensive environmental study. What, and maybe this is best for the environmental committee, but what is not being caught in those studies that, I mean, I would think with as extensive as they are, looking at these sites, some of the ill effects would be caught. So it's just something of consideration. Don't even need an answer.
All right. Representative Yaruso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two concerns. One, for the school districts, the definition of landfill says a site that was designed or operated, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't include any language about this it being a known site or a declared site or a recorded site or anything like that. And so I'm a little bit concerned that school districts would pick up some liability for sites that are unknown, unrecorded, that have been used in the past that way, because it does say whether or not it was issued a solid waste permit. So it seems to me that it kind of broadly includes undiscovered sites from the past and that the school districts would bear liability for not having notified people about those. My second concern is to pass along, I'm on the Environmental Policy Committee, and again, it has to do with this definition being too broad. How big a landfill site does this include? I live on a block that on one end of the street, there's the former Snail Lake School that's now used by the school district, and on the other end of the street, there was a lot where the farmers that lived there before would dump tires and things like that. So, you know, what qualifies as a landfill under this? I think that definition needs to be tightened up in both of those respects, and I look forward to seeing that at the next stop.
Representative Detmer, any comment? Or
we will take those recommendations to heart and tighten things up. If we need to look at the current language and make any adjustments, we'll do that.
Okay, thank you. And then Mr. Kirk Kadalka, Assistant Commissioner for Legislative and Land Policy from the PCA, has asked to testify with concerns on the bill. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kadalka. I'm an Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for the opportunity here. We do have some concerns as this bill continues to move forward, and we have talked to the author, and he's been very willing to work with us on the bill. First off, we do support public awareness of environmental sites, including old dumps. It's why we have those listed and part of the record of our What's in Our Neighborhood web tool that you can go on to and find out not only dumps but other polluted land cleanup locations. Our concern is with the ban of construction within a quarter mile as a blunt tool and doesn't take into consideration the potential risk of a site. Current landfill, a closed landfill, an old dump, they are very different. Each one is different. In the 50s and 60s, a lot of times out the outside of urban areas, folks just went and dumped materials. There are numerous ones, 1,800 that we know of in the state alone that have this characteristics. We believe a better way to do is to investigate sites and take actions to eliminate exposure pathways, remove contaminants if needed, encapsulate them, put in vapor protection barriers and other restrictions to ensure and protect public health. These programs are designed with public health and safety in mind. And remediation is always built on the intended future use. If it's being used for a parking lot, the cleanup is much different than a school or residential properties. Last year, House File 2987 by the same author took those considerations into account, where MPCA had to investigate and determine corrective actions before any possible uses for schools. Currently, MPCA does have a number of policies dealing with existing sites. We generally do not allow for a structure to be built on an old dump for a school. We have setbacks of 200 feet from waste, from current, and closed landfills. That's a little different than a dump because dumps do have different characteristics, an old dump, compared to what we think of today as a modern landfill. Another concern here is not only the building but the athletic fields. A number of parks and athletic fields across the state are built on old contaminated sites, where they have gone through the voluntary investigation and cleanup program to ensure that they've been cleaned up and also that any exposure has been stopped. The concern is that this bill does not take into consideration what remediation efforts were there to correct the problem. Madam Chair and committee members, that's just what all I have today.
Any questions? Representative Erickson. Sandra.
Thank you, Chair Brainerd. Sir, is this definition of landfill one that is either found in statute presently or that the PCA has adopted? Would you comment on that definition, please?
Mr. Kadoka.
Madam Chair and committee members, it is not a in statute now as a definition that we know of, but we are more than willing to work with the author to find the right statute, or excuse me, right definition.
Well, it sounds like you're echoing some concerns that came from members, and it sounds like Representative Detmer has agreed to work on those. Are there any other members who would like, or any other members of the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Looks like we have a familiar face coming down here, Mr. Schneiderwin from the Minnesota School Board Association. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And I had a brief hallway conversation with Representative Detmer yesterday on this bill, talking about some of the issues and some of the concerns that some of the members have had as well. And I think that all of those have been drilled on is what is the standard. And I think that Representative Krish had talked about the issue of school buildings. Anything over $500,000, school districts have to do a review and comment. And I think that is a very thorough process, and I think that if this is going to move forward, I think that may be a piece that we look at the review and comment pieces, that would be something that would be included in that. But I think this feels very broad. It does require districts, whether not sure what the definition of landfill is, but would require districts to not only notify all of their citizens, but all of their teachers who may not live in the community as well. And so we understand the importance and health of our children. I mean, that's understandable. But I think that there are some pieces here that we're concerned about, especially on the athletic fields, where perhaps out-of-town teams come in and use those fields. Or would that be something that we would be required to notify them on? Summer baseball, football, those are things that the unintended consequences that we're not sure how it's going to roll out, but I think it's something that needs to be considered by the committee.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Schneiderwin? Okay. Anyone else who would like to testify? Representative Detmer, it sounds like you've been challenged to do some work between this committee and the next.
Madam Chair, I think I just adopted two people that are going to help put this language in the form that we want. And I think we all know as legislators that we many times it's best to come out with language that is more general in nature so that people can come forward and help us to tighten things up, get the language put forth. And I think my main goal is to make sure that the public is informed. If I'm a superintendent of a school, that I want to make sure that the people in my district are informed, and I think most people will really appreciate that and that we understand that.
Okay, a final comment, Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really think it's the committee process at work in its best case scenario, so I appreciate that, and I hope we'll support it to go on to the Environment Committee so we can tighten up the language. Thank you.
So Representative Kreshaw renews his motion that House File 957 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is passed to Environment Policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Detmer. Our next bill, Representative Winkler, House File 688. The motion for Representative Winkler's bill will be to be passed and re-referred to Health and Human Service Policy. Excuse me. Who would like to move Representative Winkler's bill? Representative R. Erickson.
I'd be happy to move that we pass this bill on. Thank you.
All right. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, thank you for your consideration of the of House File 688. Members, it's a pretty simple bill. It permits school districts to stock and supply EpiPens to deal with students with severe allergic reactions to save lives, potentially, for students who may not have a prescription for their allergy pen ahead of time. Members, I have a 8-year-old who has a peanut allergy and develops other allergies over time. When we discovered it, we didn't have any EpiPens available, and if he had had a reaction in school based on some food item that we did not know about, he would not have had an EpiPen to use. And so we're going to have just, I have two testifiers who will share their comments very briefly, but the simple idea here is that trained personnel in schools should be able to save kids if the situation so requires.
And Representative Winkler, before we go to your testifiers, I see that you have an author's amendment.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Now, we're having a question here about when this amendment was submitted. I'm sorry. Well, it came in time, but he forgot to post it. But maybe you need to hold it to the next committee, because I'm going to ask what the... I see that there's concern about the fact that members haven't seen the amendment in advance. So, well, I know it doesn't matter.
Madam Chair, would it help if I spoke to the amendment?
Well, let me wait and see. Yes, Representative
Madam Chair,
Erickson.
I would recommend we waive the rule, and this is not an amendment to be considered at the next stop. It's to be here.
It's so okay.
Let us waive the rule and proceed.
Thank you, Minority Leader, for your cooperation on that. I just didn't want to do it without your consent. So, all right. So would you first, I'm going to ask Representative Erickson if he would move the A3 amendment on behalf of the bill.
I would certainly do that, yes. Thank you.
All right. So we have the A3 amendment before us. Would you like to speak to the amendment, or we could just include the amendment as to get the bill in the shape the author wants?
Madam Chair, the amendment is mostly technical in nature. There is one change at the request of the school nurses on line 2.8 to 2.9. Upon request, a printed copy of the guidelines and plan must be available at no charge. I think that's really the only substantive component of it. So,
are there any questions of the author regarding the amendment? Okay. All those in favor of the A3 amendment?
Aye.
Any opposed? So the amendment is passed and included with the bill, and could your testifiers could introduce themselves and speak to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Kaylee Dobek. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Kaylee Dobek. I'm a 16-year-old student at Centennial High School, and I have what is considered extreme anaphylaxis. This means my face, throat, tongue, as well as my nose swell shut when I come into contact with anything. I'm allergic to peanuts, tree nuts, shellfish, and most likely more. On average, it takes 3 to 7 minutes for a patient to reach full height, or in my case, less than 5. At Centennial, there are nearly 2,500 students in attendance at any point during the day. Many students have known allergies accompanied with anaphylaxis plans for staff to follow. But there are students that have allergies unbeknown to them and their families. Reactions can range anywhere from mild to anaphylaxis. In the case of anaphylaxis, epinephrine auto-injectors are the only thing that can deliver the life-saving dose of medication needed. A shot of epinephrine can save the life of anyone, and it is not dangerous or harmful to the health of any individual. I should know. I have had 4 shots of epinephrine at once and have been on epinephrine drip via IV for days. I have seen and lived through the life-saving ability of epinephrine auto-injectors in school. It saved my life twice. The most recent was Valentine's Day, of course, candy, peanuts, anything. Recently, I was given 2 shots of epinephrine at school, and I spent 9 days in pediatric intensive care in Minneapolis. It took nearly 20 minutes for an ambulance to arrive at my school. In my case, I have prescription for epinephrine auto-injectors in my school. This particular reaction called for 4 doses, as I've said, which my nurse was able to deliver because I have it available in her office. Had it not been available, I would not be here to tell you my story. Having nonspecific epinephrine auto-injectors in schools assures the safety of each and every student, as 2,500 lives in my school. Please support this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Doak. Representative Barrett, a question for the testifier?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Kaylee, for coming in today. I know it's difficult coming in talking to a bunch of politicians. You did a great job, so thank you. It's a very important topic. You had mentioned something that I thought was pretty important. You know, some of the folks came in my office a few weeks ago and just passed out one of these and kind of get us familiar with it. And I asked them a question about how dangerous it would be to do this inappropriately. And I think you answered the question, but I think it's a very important question and a very important answer. If I were to take this and put it in my thigh, if it was real, what would happen to me if I didn't need it?
Well, if you don't need it, it will basically elevate your heart rate and make you feel jittery. You might shake a little. And other than that, I mean, there's really no other symptoms if you hadn't needed it.
And Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, we do have Dr. Alan Stillerman from the Allergy and Asthma Specialist, who can probably provide a little more detail. Mm-hmm.
Sure, I'll wait on the
question.
Thank you, Representative. I know she referred to it, so I just it's obviously a lifesaver, but on the other side, it isn't a, you know, it doesn't have the same negative reaction as it would on the positive side.
Dr. Stillerman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Stillerman. I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, subcommittees on adverse reactions to food, and also subcommittees of anaphylaxis. I support the legislative measure being heard. Anaphylaxis is a serious allergic reaction that is rapid in onset and can cause death. Rapid in onset requires rapid therapy. There are 1,500 deaths from anaphylaxis annually. And there are multiple international guidelines for the management of anaphylaxis, all of which recommend epinephrine as the only first-line treatment of anaphylaxis. Data from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health Surveillance System of epinephrine administrations in schools reveals that for the 2009 academic year, there were 175 administrations of epinephrine in Massachusetts schools for the treatment of anaphylaxis. In Massachusetts, approximately 25% of anaphylactic reactions in schools were in patients who had no previous diagnosis or food allergy or anaphylaxis, and therefore had no personalized epi auto-injectors or anaphylaxis plans to manage their anaphylaxis. Let me be clear in addressing certain statements. There are no contraindications to the administration of epinephrine for the management of anaphylaxis. There are no contraindications to the administration of epinephrine for the management of anaphylaxis, but there are life-saving benefits from its administration. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Winkler. This is a great bill and a very important. I have my questions pertain to a broader climate than they do, and so I'd just like to have that conversation. My first question is, as I read through this and I thought, wow, what a great idea. I also have children that have allergies. But is there a limitation right now within the current statutes that prohibits school districts from responding reasonably to emergency situations, and why are we carving this one out?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Winkler.
Patricia, it's my understanding that this would not be permissive without a prescription by school personnel or by, unless it was by some emergency EMT type response, which may be too slow.
Representative Krisha.
And thank you for that, Representative Winkler. So I ask, are there other situations that we should be examining as well? I start to think of all the list of possibilities in the schools that, that teachers deal with, and what are we missing?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, I can't give you a definitive list. I do know that this is a, you know, for the reasons given, that this is a frontline, simple response to a life-threatening situation. And if there are other similar examples where there is a very simple frontline reaction to life-threatening situations where there's no negative consequences of doing so, I think we should probably include that as well and maybe get to more generalized language. But as of now, this is what I'm aware of.
Representative Sandra Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, would you comment on the amendment line 6 on page 4 and line 7, your deletion of third-party suppliers? Would you comment on why that's now being deleted?
Representative Winkler, when you can get to the section.
Yes.
It's page 4, lines 6 and 7. Or third-party suppliers of epinephrine from auto injectors.
Page 1 of the amendment, 114 and 15, is that
correct?
That's correct. Okay. That those are the lines on the amendment. I'm referring to the...
Madam
yes,
Chair,
Representative
Erickson, that is at the request of the Board of Pharmacy, and I couldn't give you a technical reason for it except to say that we're going to Health and Human Services policy, and we certainly will be ready for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Winkler. And I know this was a technical amendment for the most part, so thank you. I'll look forward to hearing the explanation.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Okay, Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Representative Winkler, I had a softball question for you that I wanted to throw to you. So, because I support the bill, but here's the question. Knowing your background, are we now moving to a legal climate where personnel will have to be very familiar with statutes before they, I mean, that's my concern, that you would have to know all the statutes as you're standing in an emergency situation wondering, what can I do here?
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, that's exactly what this bill would avoid by having the first of all, it's important to remember that this is completely optional. It is permissive on the part of school districts. They have to adopt a policy. They have to make that policy known. They have to conduct training. So the staff who would be responsible for reacting and in using the EpiPens would have to be well aware ahead of time what their proper response would be. So in my mind, this is exactly the opposite. It's actually getting people prepared to deal with this situation.
All right. Representative Dabney.
And so just a comment.
Representative Krisha.
Should we be empowering? Should we be broadening this? And that's as you address this, and maybe we should.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, just a quick question. I'm trying to summarize my understanding of the bill. If this passed, would this, am I correct that this allows the administration of a prescription drug to a minor child without a formal diagnosis by a trained and licensed medical professional, without neither requirement of the permission of or permission of the parents previous to the administration, nor any requirement for the notification of parents after the administration?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I obviously would not characterize it as such. And if you believe that it is necessary to have notification of the parents afterwards, I think that would be fine. I do think it would be a problem to send a note home from school to see if parents would permit the student to get an EpiPen injection while they're in anaphylaxis, however. So I think pre-approval and pre-diagnosis and a pre-prescription is the situation we have now, and I think that's a dangerous one.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Sawatsky.
Madam Chair, thank you for bringing this to the forefront. As a school teacher, every year we are mandated to review EpiPen procedures. We do it on ourselves, and we have to also get certified with the bloodborne pathogens, all those kinds of things. We also have a code blue procedure set up where there's about 20 people on our list in my school, which isn't a huge school, but we always have code blue people that are available with first aid that can come and assist the teacher. But I do see that there's with such ranges of allergies with students, and life and death can be minutes away, that I think that this is something that school teachers certainly are aware of, and most certainly this is something that, if it were in used not properly, it isn't life or death on the other end. So I think it's a win-win for those that need it the most.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Yarusa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I support this also, and echo Representative Sawatsky's testimony about the fact that teachers do receive quite a broad range of training, sometimes specific to their building, sometimes specific to the students they happen to have. But in my experience, we had training on the use of defibrillators, on seizure disorders, on the extreme allergies that some of our students had. So that's an area that's not unfamiliar to us. But also, speaking as a teacher who might have been on the receiving end of this, since I have a number of different allergies, I can speak to the immediacy of the need, that this is not something where you would, what you're treating are the symptoms, not the underlying disorder in a case of anaphylaxis. And so the symptoms are someone who is in an emergency medical distress situation. So it's not something where you would look to get permission from an outside source under those kind of conditions. The same as if you had a student who was having a heart attack, or a staff member that was having a heart attack, you wouldn't first call home to find out if the defibrillator was okay to use.
Representative Barrett, and then we do have two testifiers with concerns on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, Representative Dabney brought up a really good point regarding parental notification and whether the parents should be notified ahead of time. What is, in probably a question for the doctor, what is the most adverse negative side effect of using this on a student during the day?
Same as when you slam on your brakes and you release adrenaline from your body, you have tremor, you increase your heart rate, and it typically lasts 20 minutes. The same effect also when you would get to shake the hand of Paul McCartney.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you.
All right. All right.
You know,
I have
Barrett that we don't know.
I have on my list Mary Hyman on behalf of the School Nurses Association. And then Grace Kelleher from MSBA, if you'd both be prepared to share your concerns, please. Ms. Hyman, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Mary Hyman. I am the school nurse president. I'm the president of the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota, and I am currently a nursing service manager with Minneapolis Public Schools. I want to say thank you for the opportunity to discuss House File 688 that would allow districts to stock epinephrine stock injectors. And I also appreciate the fact that school nurses have been included in the development of this bill. And that includes that designated school personnel must be trained by medical personnel, and that annual training is required. And I did bring an extra auto injector if you're interested. If you haven't, done a hands-on, you can certainly come up and grab that. In considering this legislation, I'd like to share some of the observations of the school nurses from across Minnesota, some of my personal experiences. To give you a frame of mind, licensed school nurses are licensed by the Minnesota Department of Education, and we carry a multitude of responsibilities for the over 825,000 students in Minnesota. And primarily, we promote their health and their safety, and that's of our utmost consideration. We help with control of infectious disease, communicable diseases, such as the current outbreak in pertussis, where the numbers are as high as they've been since the 1940s. and other chronic diseases. And to answer one of the questions that was asked over here about what are some of the other concerns within the school districts, we have a very high percentage rate in Minneapolis and St. Paul, well above the average, about 5% of students with asthma. And their ability to have shortness of breath and wheezing into school would also be something to consider about looking at asthma inhalers within the school, similar to epinephrine injections. So once again, school nurses are very sympathetic to students and their families with severe allergies and anaphylaxis. And we understand that this legislation is voluntary, and there are school districts such as Anoka Hennepin that are already voluntarily stocking epinephrines. And our concern is the cost that this would the school districts would be incurred. In Anoka Hennepin, it costs them about $4,200 a year to purchase auto injectors for their 26 licensed school nurses to carry. This program has been in effect. They've been doing this since about 2006 under the direction of their medical director. And they only have the licensed school nurse carry and inject the auto injector. It is not trained to opt to anyone who recognizes the symptoms and can go ahead and administer that. If they put an auto injector in all 42 of their schools, that would be over $7,000 a year. And in Minneapolis Public Schools, for example, we have double that amount of schools that provide services to students. That would cost us basically the cost of a one-time or one day of a licensed school nurse for a full day in a building. So during the 7 years of the program that has been in place in Anoka Hennepin, the stock auto injectors have been used twice, both times for individuals previously known to have allergies. One of the members, and one of those members was a staff member who forgot to bring their auto injector at home. And our observations are that SNO members, School Nurse Organization of Minnesota, have been that it's been rare to have children without a prior diagnosis have a first-time anaphylactic reaction at school. And one of those reasons is because we do have a lot of accommodations and preventative steps in place. Some of the additional costs that we're concerned about is that an auto injector costs about $100 a piece, and they expire after 1 year. After 1 year, the epinephrine potency goes down significantly, and it really cannot be used effectively. And because of the different weights of the children, we've got kids that are less than 40 pounds and students that are greater than, 40 pounds and 50 pounds is basically the differential. We're going to need two different doses of epinephrine injectors to meet the needs of those students based on their weights. Even if the auto injectors are donated to the schools, there are costs for training, planning, developing the protocols, and ranging to get the auto injectors. And I could speak to this because I helped with the dissemination of all the AEDs in our Minneapolis public schools, and I know that's true for school nurses across Minnesota. And I spoke to a nurse yesterday, and it costs their school district, because once this is used, it's considered a hazardous material and has to be formally incinerated at the cost of about $15 a piece. So when a family does not take their epinephrine home, the school is the person that's got the responsibility to dispose of that properly. So if the stock supply is available to all students and presumably to all persons in the building, staff, parents, visitors, people at sporting events, they're not going to feel an obligation to provide auto injector for their students, knowing that there are stock epinephrine injectors at the school. The Allergy and Anaphylaxis Association has said about this bill that it means auto injectors will be available to their children if they need a second dose or forget their auto injector at home, even though the intent of this bill is for first-time allergic reactions only. Right now, it's very difficult for schools to get epinephrine injectors, asthma inhalers, for those medications that are needed for life-threatening episodes that can happen at school. And by comparison, just when it comes to stock medications, we do not stock Tylenol and antibiotic ointments for the cost or in the schools, strictly because of the cost. It costs the school districts too much money to go ahead and stock those things. So this is going to be very challenging for small rural school districts and charter schools to implement safely. Many school nurses are essential. We need school nurses to be essential in that planning. And just one more thing, the school bill allows to go beyond the academic school day. We have field trips that are walking field trips, full day school trips, and then we go on week long field trips. How do we prioritize with our stock epinephrine? Who are we going to send those out to? That needs to be further considered. So, and in my experience of training classroom teachers, they have a lot on their classroom. And they've been known, in my own experience, to inject themselves through their thumb. And it was a terrible, terrible situation. But how many non-medical people getting trained once a year would be able to accurately recognize the symptoms of an anaphylactic reaction, give the medication at the correct time with the correct technique at a very, very high anxiety moment? We could easily end up with students that with mild symptoms being injectors, with others who have more serious symptoms being overlooked.
Representative Sawatsky, question for the testifier.
Madam Chair, I'm just, you know, I know a few years ago we all had to get defibrillators in our buildings, and they were, I know we didn't have money. I was wondering how, you know, do a lot of communities rally, you know, it's another fundraiser, I don't know, but how do we fund the other things that we need to have in our buildings that costs money like this? And I guess that's...
Well, I know, for example...
Okay, excuse me, Ms. Simon.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, in our school district, our AEDs came from a national emergency response grant funded by the government. I know that local professional sports teams have sponsored AEDs for other school districts, but I really can't speak beyond that.
Okay. Representative Sawatsky?
Yeah, and I do know that when we do go on field trips, the nurse has to pack a bag. Mm-hmm. So it is, but I also am concerned about the life of somebody at the end of the day.
Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, I've witnessed a couple people that have had asthma problems, can't breathe, and all of that. It's been in a hospital setting, so I'm not making a judgment. But I'm just thinking about, is it possible to give somebody an EpiPen that it would be a missed diagnosis, like, say, maybe a heart issue? And what would the effect be on that child if it was misdiagnosed? I know there's a lot of training that goes on, but could it be deadly for them to have gotten a injection when in fact they needed something else?
Ms. Hyman?
I'm certainly not the medical doctor, but I can only refer to Dr. Stillerman's comments on the few side effects on a dose of epinephrine.
Representative Keel? Okay, all right. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And frankly, my question was along the same lines, and I see that the doctor maybe had a comment that he'd like to make on that.
Thank you. In regards to the question...
Dr. Stillerman?
Sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. In regards to the question of giving epinephrine to a patient who has an underlying illness, cardiac disease mentioned, the failure to treat anaphylaxis in that patient who's got that same underlying cardiac disease is far worse than any epinephrine. And the American College of Cardiologists and Allergists have gotten together and agreed on that point.
Okay. Representative Ertl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Doctor, I think the question is, I mean, is there some risk that there is something else that this person has that the EpiPen injection would cause harm because of?
So, Dr. Stillerman.
Madam Chair and Representatives, if there's an, so there does require a diagnosis. So it does require the recognition of the symptoms. Let's address it in the situations where there are already trained nurses and designees who have been trained by virtue of having patients with prescriptions and full formal anaphylactic plans in those schools. And now they get a patient who's a newly diagnosed situation, and supposedly those nurses are trained formally to recognize and manage anaphylaxis in a patient with a prescription. And now if they see the same thing ongoing and would like to introduce an epinephrine for that patient, they are not able to do so. With this bill, they would be able to do so at no risk to themselves if they got it wrong, if their patient didn't have anaphylaxis and they got an unnecessary epinephrine. The side effects of the unnecessary epinephrine are increased heart rate and tremor.
Okay.
Representative Ertl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, trying to simplify this. Mm-hmm. I was a teacher, so I'm out on a field trip or something, mm-hmm. and one of my students has some type of reaction, and I misdiagnose, and I, you know, give someone the injection. Can I hurt them?
Dr. Stillerman.
Madam Chair and Representatives, you can give them increased heart rate, so you need to look at if you give them an unnecessary, or even in a patient who has a previous diagnosis of anaphylaxis, there can be circumstances where they break out in a rash or they start coughing or wheezing for reasons other than anaphylaxis. Under those circumstances, an unnecessary administration of epinephrine is not going to harm them any more than increased heart rate or tremor in the vast majority of circumstances. Failure to give it when the patient is having anaphylaxis is a significant risk. And in Massachusetts, where they rely on surveillance for monitoring of these situations, 25% of patients had their first anaphylactic reactions in school settings. And I would like to emphasize that it is optional for schools to include this opportunity into their schools. And so if they already have nurses and who are trained and for and designees trained for those patients with prescriptions, then this is just extending the opportunity to apply the opportunity to give epinephrine with protection for the school nurse or who might give it, and having the device available.
Members, I want to remind you that this bill is being referred to Health and Human Services, so some of the medical concerns may be more effectively addressed there, but we do have one more testifier. Do you mind, Representative Anderson, if Ms. Kelleher testifies first? Okay, thank you. Yes, Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman and members, my name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. A lot like the school nurses, we have concerns about this bill. The discussion on whether there are any kind of bad side effects, I brought a copy of the instructions that go with the medicine, and clearly on here, it warns you about serious life-threatening side effects from epinephrine. So this is what Mylan, the folks who are really interested in seeing this bill pass, brought up as key components to keep aware of and drug interactions going forward. So I'll be happy to share the product instructions and you can read it for yourself. The school districts have concerns, but to start out with, every child that's diagnosed with a doctor's prescription about allergies has a 504 plan. We treat many of our children who bring medical issues forward with a 504 plan. That's done with a team of educators parents and the school nurse coming up with effective remedies going forward. Present law, right now, there are three kinds of medicines state law allows into public schools. They allow Tylenol only in secondary schools with a parental note. We own asthma inhalers if the child is trained and if there is a doctor's prescription going forward and parental consent. And lastly, we allow epinephrine in schools right now and also allow epinephrine in first aid kits going forward. So some of the arguments you heard today are really covered by and what is presently in law. All the stories from schools today come under the present law. But we feel this new bill in front of you has some real downsides. We're concerned that our teachers and our school staff don't have a license, and you heard the school nurse share with you about what her medical license means, and cannot diagnose a student the way a doctor can. This clearly becomes an unfunded mandate if you have a child who has an epinephrine issue in your schools. Whether there is a prescription or not, this bill brings it up. Districts have a very limited authority to dispense anything. Keep in mind, we on our own can't even dispense Tylenol. And lastly, I wonder if doctors are reluctant to write standing orders for someone to administer a controlled substance to students he or she has never even seen. Lastly, the prescription and the cost of the medicine at the local level going forward. And with that, members, we really think the present law works successfully. We have it in a first aid kit, so an issue should arise. We get on the phone with the emergency room. It's a lot better if you're under a doctor's guide. Also, there's quite a few schools across the state of Minnesota that don't have a school nurse. So the idea that someone would walk around with this in her purse isn't, or bag, isn't also always a very likely scenario. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Anderson, did you have a comment that you wanted to relate to either of the testifiers?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair, and thank you. Thank you both for showing up. I understand both sides of this issue, but I have a question regarding training. It's almost has been presented that this training is standing on its own, which I don't foresee that happening, because I'm assuming that within a school district, that there's other medical things that are being trained for. For instance, the usage of defibrillators. And if somebody was actually going to be in a training, wouldn't this be bundled into other forms of the medical training for the nurse, instead of isolating, well, this month we're going to do the EpiPens, next month we're going to do the defibrillators? That doesn't make sense to me. I have to go to annual mandatory training for my pilot certificate. I don't go in 1 month and go and say, well, this month we're going to work on engine out procedures, next month we're going to work on electrical. So that's why I'm just kind of wondering, couldn't this or shouldn't this be bundled within the training of all the other stuff anyway?
Who would like Ms. Kelleher?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, a good question. The dime that we look at when we look at staff training is sort of a daily rate, and it doesn't sound like the training might last for a day. I'm not sure about that. But we use about $16 million a day statewide to train, so if you want to chop that up into pieces. Presently, this bill covers all staff, so I know you talked about a school nurse. Not every school has a school nurse, so that might not be available. And then we would have all our staff. Should the bus driver have it? Should the custodian have it? Should the lunch lady have it? And then who would you, as a parent, feel comfortable with deciding and diagnosing whether your child is having an attack? So it's the best I can do.
Representative Anderson, does that address you? Okay. Representative Erickson, Sandra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelleher, this is voluntary if this becomes law, but if a school district does not adopt this, are they going to be subject to liability issues because a parent may be upset that the school district didn't take on this policy and administer this?
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairwoman and members, it's voluntary only in one sense. If, in fact, you have no child at your school district who needs epinephrine. Now, I would say a lot of school districts across the state have one child who may need epinephrine. So if you even have a doctor's prescription, you would then have to do all the requirements, the plan design, the procedures in the piece. I know in other states where they've tried to do this, they ended up with the board of pharmacy because they'd have to dispense mm-hmm. the epinephrine. I mean, that's a federal requirement. That doesn't change. So I think it brings a lot of questions into mind about how this would proceed when you get into something this large. And certainly I can imagine there'd be EpiYes and EpiNo schools going forward.
Representative Erickson?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that sets the record straight.
Okay. Representative Isaacson?
No, pass.
All right. Representative Winkler, did you want to comment?
Oh, Madam Chair, I can wait until you're
all right.
Through.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill?
Madam Chairman, I'd like to make a comment.
Yes, Ms. Hyman. Sorry.
Under the Minnesota Nurse Practice Act, Minnesota allows for delegation, which is I, as a licensed professional, can train any one of you to use an EpiPen or an auto-injector or give an asthma inhaler if I feel that, you know, you're deemed competent, and likewise, you know, you feel that you've received the proper training and we have a written plan by the prescribing provider. And the way that delegation is under the Nurse Practice Act, it's written for a very specific situation and scenario of a student's symptoms. So right now, there are students for the students in Minneapolis, there's approximately 587 students who have diagnosis of food allergies. I can't speak to the number of EpiPens, but it's significant. So we have done training on an individual basis with these students because each of their symptoms may vary just a bit, and that's going to be true for any other medication that we're going to be delegating a classroom assistant to. So I just the training piece is not part of a routine at this point. But based on the current statute and law of nurse practice and pharmacy, it needs to be individualized rather than a group sort of training.
So, Representative Winkler, I would say that, like the bill that preceded you, a number of issues have been raised that you might want to take under consideration between here and your next committee. Well, but if you have some comments, I'd like to, yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and particularly I wanted to respond to Representative Erickson. I would point her to lines 4.26 through 5.2, and specifically line 4.28 and 4.29. It says that the district or school is immune from liability for any act or failure to act made in good faith in implementing this section. So there would be no liability as a result of passing this law. The entire program is voluntary. It is permissive. And if, frankly, if there are concerns about liability, that can be addressed in civil law. I don't believe that there are any. And I don't understand how you can possibly have an unfunded mandate when you don't have a mandate. You have an unfunded option, perhaps, but I don't know that that is quite as dangerous.
Okay. So Representative Roger Erickson renews his motion that House File 688 be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
The motion passes. Prevails and the bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Winkler, and I hope you'll have the opportunity to continue some of these discussions. All right, we do have two bills remaining on the agenda. If we do not finish, we'll be reconvening at 6 o'clock tonight in room 300 South. Representative Bly is going to present House File 361, Representative Slocum's bill. Representative Bly is a co-author of the bill.
Madam Chair, if I could ask for some advice, it occurs to me that perhaps the second bill, 166, which I've also been asked to present, may take less time as it's going to be just laid over for possible consideration. We might be able to get through that and then have
right.
that done, and then we can devote more time to the other bill. Would
if
you?
No one has any objection to that.
I think you can do both bills. Yeah.
Well, yes, we'll work on that. So, all right, Representative Bly, would you like to move House File 166?
Yes.
What is your
I
motion?
I would like to move House File 166 and recommend that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the
okay, so
policy bill.
With that motion, to your bill.
Okay.
Or
and,
to Representative
first
Slocum's
let me say
bill.
That this is not my bill. It's Representative Slocum's. Yes. Right. I'll do my best to be as irreverent as Representative Slocum would be.
That may be a challenge. Representative
this,
Bly.
This bill has to do with students who are in treatment either for chemical abuse or chemical use or psychiatric or related kinds of treatment, and allowing them to continue if they are able, physically able, in extra curricular activities, not to be excluded in any other way than other students might be excluded. I hope I explained the bill that well. And we do have one testifier.
Yes, Ms. Abderholden, would you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness. We have had a couple of situations where students were in a care and treatment program, particularly day treatment program for their mental illness. They were involved in extracurricular activities and then were told, well, no, because you're not really attending school here, you can't be involved. And, you know, I think it's really hard for, you know, a young person who's maybe involved in a play or orchestra or cheer or something like that not to be able to stay involved in that piece of it, especially if the therapist and everyone agrees that that would be a good thing. I will note that the high school league does allow students to continue, so this would really make it parallel with the high school league rules.
All right. Yes, Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is doesn't the high school league have rules against drug and alcohol use? I mean, and I believe that this bill includes that as well. And so if somebody is saying, well, I need to go to rehab for drug use, aren't they admitting that they're using drugs and therefore shouldn't they be disqualified under the high school rules?
Ms. Alderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Faust, I believe that there is an exception. So if they're... and I'm sorry I don't have the rules with me today because otherwise I wouldn't have made it if I stopped at my office first. But I believe that there is an there are some exceptions to that. We actually, this was introduced last year, and we worked with the School Board Association and the principals to talk about could there even just be a letter that went out just clarifying this for districts because we've had some districts that have said, well, of course we would let kids participate, and then, of course, we have some that they weren't allowed to.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would be extremely supportive of the mental health part of this, mm-hmm. but I guess I'd have concerns of the drug and alcohol stuff.
My understanding is that...
Representative Bly.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that they would be excluded the same way other students would be excluded if they didn't qualify because of known use or whatever. And I don't know the exceptions that are in the rule, but they would be subject to the same... restrictions.
So
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if they would normally be disqualified mm-hmm. from the high school yep. league rules by admitting they're yep. using drugs, then they would be excluded the same as it would be otherwise. All right. I think that clears that up. Thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
I want to make sure I understood that you're saying that if someone's in alcohol or drug treatment, thank you, Madam Chair, sorry, treatment, thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. Alcohol or drug treatment, that they this would not apply to them? Is that what I just understood you guys to say?
Excuse me, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson. What we're saying is that if there are already rules applying to the use of drugs and alcohols and your ability to participate in some activity, mm-hmm. Those don't go away. It's just by virtue of just being in a care and treatment program alone would not disqualify you from participating. That's the only thing that we're changing.
Madam Chair,
Representative Isaacson,
I have to say that I'm with Representative Faust on this one. If it was the mental health aspect, I agree. But if it's a drug and alcohol situation, there's higher priorities than football or plays at that point going on that require different kinds of treatment. And so I'm not. Gosh, I just couldn't support that right now.
There. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to disagree with Representative Isaacson. The high school league rules are not a lifetime ban from sports. On the and I happen to have them in front of me, but on the first offense, it's a two-game suspension. And drug and alcohol treatment takes longer than that. And so if someone has agreed to go into treatment and they are working on their life, this is a positive step forward. And the proposed bill language already acknowledges that they would still be subject to whatever rules the high school league has in that regard. The rules the high school league has escalate with the number of violations someone has had. And I don't understand what purpose would be served by banning a student who has gone forward and is cooperating with treatment from getting back on track with their life under a more, you know, more strictly than what the high school league would already say.
So, members, there's a number on the list, but we have a couple of testifiers that might help enlighten our questioning here. Roger Aronson.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Roger Aronson. I represent the School Principals Associations and the High School League as well. And this bill was offered last year when Representative Erickson chaired the committee, and we didn't hear it. I think one of the reasons you're struggling here a bit is this statute that talks about control of extracurricular activities has one special group, and that's homeschool students, because they're not enrolled in the public school. And this statute says then they're eligible to participate in extracurriculars. Good thing to always remember that extracurriculars is a broader category than high school league activity. You know, it might be the school play, it might be a lot of other things that aren't high school league activities. Students do not lose their eligibility to participate in those activities simply because they're temporarily placed in a care and treatment program. Right. There's nothing that says that. And as Ms. Aberholden talked about, there are some districts that may errantly have said that somewhere, but if they did, it's legally incorrect. We thought the solution to this would be to send a letter to everybody, in which we've talked about with NAMI and the School Board Association and the school principals, that we can say, hey, just so you know, when kids go into these programs, they don't lose their eligibility to participate in these activities. But as the members are pointing out, if they have done some other things connected to eligibility, used drugs, were engaged in an assault, whatever that might be, they would do those penalties in the timelines within which that you've seen there. So we actually don't think you need the bill,
right?
Because we think that is the status of the law as it exists. Student does not lose his eligibility in those circumstances, even though someone might have said they did, that would be wrong.
Okay, comment?
Absolutely. Yes,
and Representative Bligh, do you have a comment on this?
I simply say that we're asking that this issue be laid over for consideration. I think if there's concerns about whether or not we should exclude students who've gone through chemical treatment or whatever, I think the advocates would be willing to take that out. But we're raising the issue, hoping that the committee chair may look at it and determine whether or not it's necessary to include.
I'd like to go to Representative Sandra Erickson because she has dealt with this previously, and I'd take some input from her on whether we're laying it over for possible inclusion is the right move here, if there's disagreement about its, you know, the appropriateness of the action.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think Mr. Aronson has stated it exactly the way we discussed it previously when this provision came to our committee, or potentially would have been heard in committee. I don't see a need for this. I didn't see a need for it when I was chair. It basically is a statute that deals with, as Mr. Aronson said, with allowing homeschool students to participate on the same basis as public school students. So the high school league has its rules, and as far as I know, that is what the coaches and school officials and students actually know. So I don't see a need for adding this new language. But that, of course, is up to the committee. But I think Mr. Aronson has stated it very accurately.
So,
Madam Chair, can we add
yes,
one thing?
Mr. Aronson.
Ms. Aberholden and I have talked about this before, and we've talked to Representative Slocum about this. we wanted to put on the record here, and Mr. Schneiderman as well, that we are going to send this letter out to schools that say the fact that these kids move to these other treatment facilities does not change their eligibility to participate in any extracurricular. We wanted to put that on the record here today, that that's kind of the compromise, and that maybe we can put this issue to sleep as it goes forward.
Well, so we still have the motion before us to move House File 166 over for possible inclusion, but with this discussion in mind, I will take a vote on the motion, but assume there there will be further discussion.
No, there's
no. We don't.
You don't have.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's for inclusion. So that's my
Sherry,
mistake.
Sherry, you will decide.
Yes. Okay. So we will move it for possible inclusion, with the understanding that the parties will continue to discuss before the bill is shaped, and before we have to make that decision. With that, we'll move to the last bill. We may finish here today. Sorry for that mistake. I appreciate the support of more experienced chairs in our midst. Representative Bly, would you like to move House File 361?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 361 for a vote and refer to Education Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Bly has moved House Files 361 be passed and referred to the Committee on Education Finance. To the bill, Representative
yes.
Bly.
Like some of the issues we've heard already this morning, this bill attempts to address some conversations about how we best serve students who have particular needs in our schools. And oftentimes, in these issues, we end up arguing over who should pay, who should provide this service, and many times it's the students who suffer the most because of our lack of clarity. This bill tries to give some clarity to that issue so that we know that they can receive the services that they need, and I'd like to refer to the testifier to say more about it.
Ms. Abderholder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. You know, you've heard a lot this session about the unmet needs of children with mental illnesses and, frankly, the difficulties that our schools are having also in meeting their needs. For some children with mental illnesses whose needs are very high, they need treatment in a therapeutic day treatment program or in a residential treatment facility. Few of them will then have access to a full day of education, thus putting them behind academically with their peers. Treatment facilities and schools need to work together to provide education to these students while also ensuring they receive the treatment that they need. The state laws governing education, both regular and special ed, and transportation that's provided to these students are confusing, spread out in several areas, and frankly result in a lot of disagreements over who pays for what and where a student should go. NAMI has heard from families who were frustrated by the disagreements with their school districts when the school said they wouldn't transport their child to a day treatment program recommended by the mental health professional. Other parents were concerned when they discovered their district's day treatment program was not actually a clinical program. Districts would fight with each other about the bills for providing education. Transportation coordinators had a heck of a time figuring out which children went where. Students would sometimes face long bus rides from their day treatment program back to their school each day for their education. And clinical day treatment and residential providers were upset by the lack of coordination with some districts and their inability to have a say in the training of the teachers placed in their programs. I think in sum you could say that it was a mess. About 3 years ago, NAMI Loving Tough Issues pulled together a group of people, both educators, you know, special educators and mental health professionals, to say what could we do differently. It has been, frankly, a very difficult journey to try to figure out how to change the law. What you have before us is the result of those 3 years of work. We've put all the care and treatment language in one section of the law. It used to be in several different sections. It recognizes that these students are particularly at high risk for dropping out of school. It requires schools and treatment providers to work more closely together to ensure that the teachers of these students understand mental illnesses and the therapeutic part of their day. It allows the state to certify education programs that are provided by the Department of Correction and by treatment programs where the treatment and education is integrated throughout the day. It creates a state fund to pay for the education and transportation costs to cut down on the battles between providing and resident districts. It allows students to go to the treatment program that meets their medical need without it being decided by the school district. It clarifies that a day treatment program under the Department of Human Services is a mental health day treatment program. This is not a level 5 EBD program. And it allows parents to be paid round trip for transportation to encourage them to provide the transportation and reduce the burden on school districts. I know that this is not a perfect bill. Anytime you try to take a big issue like this and try to create something new, I know that there's probably some flaws in it. We just heard from the Department of Human Services last night with a list of amendments. But I do think it's an important step forward to try to battle this issue. Let me also say that the proposed changes to the special ed funding formula would impact this. So I think they kind of have to go together like this until we figure out what's going to happen with special ed funding. But again, I think that this is an issue that we need to somehow tackle, and I do recognize what a big issue it is.
Questions, members?
And I know we have several testifiers.
We do have several testifiers.
We have 4 minutes
four
left
minutes?
In the otherwise we're going to hold. We're going to reconvene tonight at 6 p.m. So you have to make it.
If we could have someone who can come back.
All right. Welcome to committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Keith Kozorski, and I'm the Director of Children's Services for Catholic Charities here in the Twin Cities. And we operate two care and treatment programs at St. Joseph's Home for Children in South Minneapolis. We're here in support of this legislation because, as Ms. Abderholden pointed out, care and treatment programs require two distinct groups of professionals to cooperate. They require the cooperation of treatment, mental health professionals, and education professionals. Those professionals are trained in very different disciplines and often disagree on the best way to do things. This legislation will help create some pathways for greater agreement among those professionals. It will help us to delineate funding, transportation, staffing, and other issues that frequently come up when we try to develop these programs. The other thing that excites treatment professionals about this legislation is it increases the available school time to students in day treatment programs. One of the main things we're doing in our mental health work is teaching kids skills to be able to participate in the education process. Without those skills, kids are getting suspended, ending up in fights in the community, and then ending up in our juvenile justice system. By increasing the available school time to those students, they're able to practice the skills that are learning in the mental health treatment programs and learning how to become better functioning members of their school community. And lastly, this legislation would also allow treatment programs to have the opportunity to hire education professionals that would work for the treatment provider and offer an education program that follows regulations as set forth by the Minnesota Department of Education, but allow them to operate a full education program to avoid some of the struggles that happen when you have two different bodies trying to offer those services. Thank you for the opportunity to offer my insight.
Members, any quick questions for the testifier? If not, yes, Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not specific to his testimony, but does this require services to begin to be offered within 3 days? In the case where you've got students that might be in a 1 to 2 week hospitalization kind of situation. Frequently that's out of town because of the lack of beds in the Twin Cities. So the language, you know, requires the district to be offering it within 3 days, but does it have to be, must the students start resuming their education within that time?
Madam Chair and
Mr. Kozorowski?
Kozorowski, thank you.
Kozorowski, all right.
Yes, it does, and most districts already have operating agreements and educational programs that are appropriate for those short-term stays in psychiatric facilities.
Okay, with that, the meeting stands in recess until 6 p.m. tonight in room 300 South. So the committee will come to order and we'll continue on House File 361, Representative Slocum's bill that Representative Bly is presenting. We've had some testimony already, and my understanding is there are two additional testifiers and then someone with concerns about the bill. So, okay. Representative Bly.
That's right, Chair Brainard. And so, yeah, go ahead. And we're going to try to keep our testimony brief.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Todd Archbold. I'm a social worker and currently the Chief Development Officer at Prairie Care. Prairie Care provides specialized mental health and psychiatric services to all ages and has a strong emphasis on providing acute care services to children and adolescents. We operate three care and treatment programs in the Twin Cities that balance providing intensive therapeutic support services with educational services. Children and families are often in our programs anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks at a time, depending on treatment goals and progress. We've established an excellent relationship with Intermediate District 287, who provide the educational and classroom services to children in our programs. This allows children to stay connected to structured academics and on track with credits while they receive critical therapeutic and psychiatric services. While our collaboration plus treatment education model is built on sound principles, there's much confusion surrounding the current laws dictating education requirements in care and treatment. We often have to reference 8 different statutes and rules to help explain to parents and schools the responsibilities for education and transportation. This often results in a lapse of educational services for days at a time. Ambiguity exists over educational responsibilities by the districts that lead to parents feeling deserted, discordant, and at times adversity among professionals. This results in chaos and confusion for children during their most vulnerable times, losing connection to school and academics. The same problematic confusion exists around transportation responsibilities for kids in care and treatment, which amplifies the chaos for families, and even worse, becomes a complete barrier to kids receiving treatment altogether. Although the spirit of the current laws mean well, the language and changing environment of care and treatment has created problems. Children with mental illness and treatment are missing valuable education services and are being denied transportation due to confusion and subsequent adversity. I'm here in support of this bill to please help streamline the critical services for kids who need them at the critical times. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Archibald? Not your next testifier? You can stay. Either way, but there's not another chair, I guess. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good evening, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Dan Naditz. I'm the Director of Special Education for the Northeast Metro Intermediate District 916. I am a member of the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, MACE, and I wanted to take a few minutes today, I'll be brief, to speak in support of House File 361, the Care and Treatment Bill. MACE worked with a large group that included NAMI, Care and Treatment Representatives, and other advocacy groups. Though there are a few questions and areas that need some clarity before MACE can fully support this bill, I want to address some of the very positive aspects. This bill adds clarity to the definitions and condenses 3 laws into 1, which is very positive. This bill also moves the responsibility of providing education to the district in which the treatment center is located in. Currently, the district in which the student lives in is responsible for the education. Sometimes children go to a program that is quite a distance from their home, and the resident district is still responsible for the education. That distance makes it difficult for the resident district to coordinate and provide education. This proposed bill would place the responsibility with the district in which the treatment is located and may support that change. This bill also proposes a care and treatment fund that would pay for children educated in treatment programs for 31 school days or more. Short-term programs, less than 30 school days, would continue to be paid for by the resident district. MACE supports a system where the educational costs for students participating in care and treatment programs for longer than 31 school days are not billed back to the resident district, but rather paid for by the care and treatment fund. There are times when a student may need care and treatment and is doing fairly well in school. In those incidents, districts are reluctant to pay for the cost of education and care and treatment. This separate fund would eliminate that issue and increase access for children and families to receive treatment. MACE supports the creation of the Care and Treatment Fund. There still remain some questions and a need for clarity related to who is responsible for compliance with state and federal laws related to the provision of special education. There's provision in the proposed bill that would give care and treatment centers an opportunity to enter into a memorandum of understanding with the providing district. If this occurs, there are questions as to who is ultimately responsible for the education of students and the supervision of the staff. In general, MAE supports the bill. However, there needs to be some revisions to the current language. We're willing to work with the stakeholders group to create this language that clearly identifies the responsibility of the schools and the treatment centers for educating students in care and treatment. Thank you.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Faust.
Thank you very much. This might be, at least start with Representative Bland, as to why is the funding set up that way, that in the district where the treatment is being offered, unless you don't agree with the statement that he made, that's the situation, because there'd be a significant disincentive for any community to start a treatment center and try to chase them out of town if that ends up to be the case. So can you explain why it is that way if that is in fact the case? And I'm sorry to put you on a spot because I know this isn't your bill, but if you could, please.
Madam Chair and Representative Faust, I think I'm going to have Sue Everholton answer that question because I'm sure she's more familiar with the bill than I am.
Welcome, Ms. Everholton. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sue Everholton, NAMI, Minnesota. Madam Chair, Representative Faust, that's why we're creating this kind of state fund so that we would not have that disincentive, but making sure instead of the district where the treatment facility is located, also working with the district where the child resides, you get into this tug of war about who's going to pay for what and are you charging me too much. And so we just kind of get rid of that by saying we would have the state fund that would pay for that.
I hope I'm right in this, but I think also there has to be coordination of what's happening as well. So if that remains with the home district and they're a great distance away, I mean, sometimes it's difficult to find care and treatment, and you have to send students a great distance. So to transfer that kind of ability to make decisions to the district that's closer to the center may make more sense.
I understand that, but I think that the previous testimony, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, made a very good point that, you know, that it doesn't make sense to do it that way unless the state is paying for it. And if that's the case, then doesn't that alleviate your concerns, Mr. I'm sorry, I don't even want to try to pronounce that.
Natus.
Mr. Natus, come, yes.
Would it alleviate those concerns? Yes, if there was a fund created by the state where education for care and treatment was paid for that way, it would eliminate that.
Okay. And my understanding, according to what I've heard, is that, I'm sorry, that it actually does do that. So, okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Other questions for either Representative Bly or the testifiers? If not, Representative Bly, any closing comments? We have
some
Mr. Lundell, you had signed up to express some concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell tonight here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation. And we worked with this working group or task force, and we really thank Sue Everholton for putting us on that and having us in the discussions. But there's a couple of clauses in Section 14, which starts at the bottom of page 10 and goes through the page 11, line 17. If you move up to Clause 4, which is page 11, line 6, talking about transporting three children to a facility outside district boundaries, we need some clarification there because many districts transport three kids by 9 a.m. are at a program outside their district. Other might not be for a whole year. But I think that there's an issue there as to how the reimbursement is going to take place and how that's going to proceed. I think that we were under the impression as going through the discussions that, as in the case where Representative Faust talked about, that there would be a state fund and that the state fund would pay for the transportation necessary to transport children. We're just children to these programs were kind of confused by that language. I think the other language or the other problem is that some districts have really, and this is a contentious issue, but some districts have worked very, very hard to say that we will transport to these programs, and this is your menu as a parent that we'll provide transportation to these programs. And some districts have worked very, very hard to say, you know, this is, you know, these are the, this is the menu of options that you have, because in some cases there are programs that are, you know, well away from the district that that folks will be requesting transportation for, and unless there's funding there for that, and even if there is funding for that, it is, can get very, very difficult to coordinate. You can sometimes have districts hiring taxi cabs and sending kids in taxis, you know, on a 30-mile trip or something like that. So those are issues I think that we're concerned about looking forward. We'd like some clarification there.
And this bill will be referred to Ed Finance, so that may be an appropriate point at which to require some clarification of the bill's author.
Okay.
Any questions for this testifier? Comments? Is there anyone else who would like to comment on the bill in the audience? Ms. Kelleher? Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chairman and members, I'm Grace Kelleher. I represent the School Boards Association, and we just have some general concerns I'd like to share with you. We spent some time really trying to digest this bill and figure out what it means. And probably the most problematic two pages are pages 8 and 9. On line 811, it talks about a screening for a child's educational and behavioral needs. It doesn't clarify what that screening would be for. So I, you know, if we could, and I bet Ms. Abderholden could tell us off the top of her head. The next section, sub 6, as you go down, says that basically here the school district, the providing district, and I think the care and treatment all must jointly agree on what happens to the child. And we're not so much concerned about that, but what if they don't agree? How is that handled? How would that go forward? On 820, it says, the providing district and care and treatment program shall develop emergency discipline and behavioral procedures consistent with applicable state and federal law. The question would be, would that be for a care and treatment center, or would that be for a K-12 school? Mm-hmm. So some clarification on those two. If you go down to page 1.8.3, it says, it talks about a student year and basically having this care and treatment if it would require a year-round schooling or, in effect, I wrote it down so I could get it right. They agree that...
What line are you on?
I'm on 8.32 and 8.31. There's a section there that talks about the school year for a child in this kind of placement setting. And as we read that language, it says it cannot be less than one-half of the amount of instructional time in a school day. And I think our concern is if the care and treatment team establishes that it needs to be less than half-time, you know, we need just some clarity on how you'd like us to handle that going forward. And I know I came in just on the tail end, Madam Chairman, and I apologize for being late. On the bottom of 9.26, there's a discussion about how we pick up with the state fund and when we go forward. And I read that line to say treatment programs for 31 or more school days. So if you're 31 and under, your local resident school district would be on the hook for that. 31 and over, the state would pick up. And we just encourage you to consider the cost of all those days. And there was one earlier statement. We had some requirement about when, and I want to go back, when the district had, it basically, kids in these programs get put there sometimes by the parents, sometimes by the court, but usually not the school district. The problem is when they're placed in a care and treatment facility, that facility doesn't always notify the school district that the child has been placed in that program. So I know earlier today we talked about the number of days before educational programs should be started and notification of when that. And we really encourage you to say when the school district receives notice. So when we're told either by the parents or the courts or whoever has placed that child, we need some kind of notification that that placement has occurred.
Questions for Ms. Kelleher? So like many of the bills we've heard today, it sounds like between here and the next stop, there's maybe some clarification with the bill's author and possibly, you know, you want to work toward a resolution of those concerns. I don't know if Ms. Abderholden wants to comment on any of the issues you raised.
Madam Chairman, I'd just like to say this author has been tremendous all day to sit in the hot seat. And Ms. Abderholden, as always, is usually fantastic to work with. But we really received the seriousness of this legislation and thought we needed to put our heads together. There are other technical changes that we picked up in regard to charter schools. And the bill talks about a charter school having boundaries. Well, it doesn't have physical boundaries like a school district. So we'd like the ability to work with Ms. Abderholden and talk to the author about the more technical few changes that we were able to pick up in the bill.
Representative Blythe, did you want to comment?
Maybe just to say that, you know, you do hit upon a couple of the things that the bill, I think, is trying to accomplish, and that's to address the issue of bringing together school districts and care centers and having them talk together to resolve some of the issues. I hope I'm accurate in getting at that. And then also the whole issue of how the services get paid for, and rather than spending all kinds of time and effort arguing about that, it's trying to bring clarity to that process.
Thank you, Representative Bly. And I think it's clear that there's some agreement about the need, but that the bill has some details that need to be clarified.
Thank you, Chair. And I think that's true, and I think in her testimony earlier today, Sue Abderholden did talk about there are things still need to be worked on, and she's in process doing that. So okay. I think it's clear that that will happen.
So Representative Bly renews his motion that House File 361 be passed and referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The bill passes. What does it say? The motion prevails, and the bill is passed.
And referred to
the meeting is adjourned. And referred to K-12 finance.
Thank you.